Substance abuse is common among male and female inmates in South Dakota prisons. Department of Social Services statistics show that in 2017, 87% of adult offenders were substance dependent at the time of intake. However, more women are incarcerated for drug offenses than men, 65% of female inmates versus 27% of males, while more males are in prison for violent offenses than females, 47% to 14% respectively. SDPB's Michael Zimney reports.
There's more than one path to the halls of power in Pierre. Some run for office and win. Others take an early morning shuttle from the women's prison. Christine Wilson and Millicent Brown can often be seen at the Capitol in their uniform of khakis and blue polos, vacuuming the floors beneath portraits of former governors, or emptying the trash bins at legislators' desks in the House and Senate chambers. Wilson and Brown are both serving time for drug offenses, and both hope that this is their last bid at the women's prison.
I started out when I was 12, and when I grew up, partying was okay, and I never got in trouble until I moved here to South Dakota. So we'd party on the weekends, work during the week, and when I moved here, I started having kids, and I started having back problems, so I was prescribed opiates for a while, and then I was addicted to them for about 20 years, and then I started with like pot and meth. And then this last time I got in trouble, I had been taking Subutex to not be on the opiates, and I ended up relapsing on meth. So it's been a lifelong struggle for me.
Wilson says she supplied her opiate addiction through legal means when possible with a doctor's prescription. When her prescriptions ran out or a doctor cut her off, she had to find other ways to avoid withdrawal.
I started out with prescriptions, and then I would just get them off the street because I didn't go to a doctor for a long time. But then I did live in Mitchell for a while after my last two prison stays ago, and I was on morphine and oxycodone for 5 years from a doctor. So that was a pretty heavy addiction. It wasn't fun. But I don't know, I started abusing them, and I would run out, so I'd have to go buy them on the street.
It was expensive, though.
Like, we used to buy people's whole prescriptions for $300, or if you buy one pill, it can run between 10 and 20.
But it wasn't the money that got her in trouble with the law. Wilson is currently serving time for possession of a controlled substance.
I got pulled over, and the cop ran a dog around my car, and they found meth in the car, in my purse.
Possession charges have repeatedly sent her back to the women's prison.
Drug possession or dirty UAs.
A UA is a urinalysis. Through her struggles with addiction, Wilson said she's always tried to make ends meet legally.
I always worked. I'd worked 2 and 3 jobs.
And while dealing with the demands of work, family, and addiction, Christine got introduced to meth. Today she's 48. She wears her hair long, pulled back in a ponytail. She has the unaccessorized look of a person who's incarcerated. She doesn't have the gaunt, skeletal look of the archetypal addicts you may have seen in magazines. If anything, she's jowly, stout. But everything about her, from her teeth to her world-weary demeanor, is working class. She projects the air of someone who's tired, of living precariously, of going back to prison. But she doesn't project sadness. She looks straight at you when she speaks. She seems resolved to make a change, to do what life requires of her without the boost or escape that drugs can offer. She seems to look forward to the future. She says she never really wanted meth in her life anyway.
At first, I didn't really care for it, and then I went through a bad time 2 years ago. My mom had passed away, and I was taking care of a special needs kid. He's my son's half-brother, and so I was just overwhelmed. I was out on parole, and stuff happened, and I was trying to work and take care of everybody, and I wasn't taking care of myself. So I didn't even like it at first, but I just kept doing it.
Meth. Nowadays, mere mention of the word is disruptive, conjuring images of unkempt tweakers. By the time Nick Redding started studying the small-town meth epidemic for his influential book, Methland, he said that meth users had entered the lexicon as caricatures, which ultimately stemmed less from the drug and more from the environs with which that drug was associated. One of the more surprising revelations in Methland is that the drug didn't always have such a grubby reputation. Methamphetamines have been prescribed in pill and inhaler form since the 1930s, and since then, people have been using them as means to stay awake and on the job. The truly singular aspect of meth's attractiveness, writes Redding, is that since its first wide-scale abuse among soldiers during World War II, meth has been associated with hard work. Then in the late 70s, several socioeconomic factors converged. The industrial Midwest went into decline, wages for blue-collar workers stagnated or fell, the 80s farm crisis left former farmers landless. As people migrated away from small towns, it got harder for those who stayed to make a living. Some worked two or three jobs just to get by. One of the appeals of meth is that a person could work a double shift without feeling tired, hungry, thirsty, anything that might slow you down. At the same time, outlaw chemists started undercutting the pharmaceutical companies by cooking up purer, cheaper versions of methamphetamines that could be smoked or injected. All of these factors combined made meth what Redding describes as the perfect American drug and an epidemic waiting to happen. By the early 2000s, when the general public became aware of the problems and side effects associated with late-stage meth addiction, that association of meth with hard work may have faded, at least for a lot of people, but not for everybody. Christine Wilson and Millicent Brown both say they were attracted to meth as a means of coping with the crush of daily life, of matching the demands of work and single motherhood hour for hour.
I'd quit for periods of time and then I'd start again. I was always trying to get that extra day, that extra hour out of a day, that extra time. And it was just easier to do that if you stayed awake. If you stayed awake all night and studied, if you stayed awake and all night and did laundry, if you stayed awake all night and got things ready for the week.
Millicent Brown is 35 and has the look of a former MMA fighter, because she is one. She wears her long black hair in a single braid that reaches her waist and has simple black ink tattoos on both of her arms. If meth is supposed to scar people outwardly for life, it seems to have spared her. Like Christine, she does carry a visible weight, but it vanishes when she smiles, which she does often. An enrolled member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe, Brown grew up mostly in McLaughlin, a small town on the reservation, but as a kid she was often on the move.
Washington, back to McLaughlin, to California, to McLaughlin, Minnesota, to McLaughlin. My mom was just kind of that way. She moved around a lot, and a lot of it, I think, had to do with her substance abuse or just kind of trying to start over all the time. She could be very loving, but when she was intoxicated, she's very mean. I mean, she's very abusive. And she's a completely different person, I can say that much. But when she was sober, she was great.
When Brown was 12, she says she and her younger brother went to live with their Aunt Marie, a teacher at the Sitting Bull School in McLaughlin.
Watching my aunt, she was kind of my biggest inspiration. She had always told me growing up, she was like, it doesn't matter where you start from. She was like, you can always change. You have that ability to change. And so she was my biggest role model. And she instilled good qualities in me and did her best. But I mean, I think just from the abuse and the watching, you know, having to grow up so fast around my mom, I just kind of had always gotten used to doing things my own way. My aunt did try her best, you know. She would always tell me, just be a kid, just be a kid. But I was so used to that caretaker role that I would still constantly go back to my real mom and check on her and check on her and what was going on. And
at 12 years old, she didn't feel like a kid anymore.
Growing up fast, you know, I always had older friends. I never really had a lot of peers my own age that I hung with. I really felt like I had nothing in common with them because, you know, I wasn't worried about a lot of the things that they were worried about. I was worried about, I got to get home to my grandma who's sick and doesn't have anybody to watch her right now because my mom's drunk. So at my lunchtime, I don't get to sit and visit with you guys. I got to go check on my grandma and then come back to school. I got to go check on my little brother who couldn't go to school that day because he was sick or he didn't have clean clothes and I didn't have time. You know, I had other responsibilities.
And despite her aunt's best efforts, as a teenager growing up fast in McLaughlin, Brown was being pulled in different directions.
Being around certain family members and seeing, geez, you know, they sell just a little bit of that and look at how much money they make, as opposed to watching my aunt who had a job her whole life and she struggled, you know, I mean, she could barely get ends met sometimes. And so it was just watching that fast money and I wanted that. And then it just kind of led to higher things. Like it went from dealing pot to dealing meth to using meth. And it was like a gradual increase in life. You know, it just kind of, until it was no longer maintaining the addiction started maintaining me.
Like Christine Wilson's, Brown's addiction also turned into a decades-long struggle, punctuated by multiple prison stays, the birth of her kids, periods of sobriety followed by eventual relapse, family reunifications followed by lost custody. Over the years, she has repeatedly found herself trying to do something her mother had often tried to do, start over. The last time she started over, she was drawn to Aberdeen.
I moved to Aberdeen to give myself and my kids an opportunity at jobs and just something different than the reservation life, because it can be hard at times, and I'm not trying to say that there are not good things there. There are not exactly all the greatest things. So I just wanted my kids to see something better, so we chose Aberdeen as a family. And I was still struggling with my, you know, issues, and I was trying to raise them and have just be a single mom raising four kids by myself, usually on minimum wage. Two of them are autistic, and it was keeping IEPs, keeping jobs, and then I sobered up. I was a year and 11 months clean, and I relapsed at a boxing match.
Brown had also picked up boxing in McLaughlin, encouraged by a trainer there named Gary Ortley, who runs the Hunkpapa Oyate Boxing Club. Fighting was something that helped keep her out of trouble for a while, but then she relapsed on the night she lost an MMA match at the Prairie Nights Casino back on the reservation. Things spiraled from there.
I was under the influence while around my children, and it's considered child abuse. And then I had an altercation with my oldest daughter. We fought. It's nothing I'm proud of.
She went back to prison, lost custody of her kids. A couple years later, when she was released on felony probation, she found herself with a new problem, too much time.
And I just was dealing with so much because I was trying to get custody of my kids back, because when I got all my charges, they were taken away, and it was hard because I didn't have that responsibility, so I had all this extra time, and I just kept filling the void with other things, and it was crazy because I didn't like drinking, but it was that cross addiction thing. And then they finally got tired of it, and they revoked it.
She was 4 months pregnant when her probation was revoked. She gave birth to her youngest son while incarcerated at the women's prison.
I got to keep him for 30 days. And then he went home with his dad, who he himself was struggling with his own addiction, and he wound up going to prison himself. And so we both currently sit in prison right now, and our son is being raised by his sister.
Millicent Brown and Christine Wilson are both eligible for work release or parole this summer. They both say they want to stop using, stop ending up at the women's prison, and mend their relationships with their kids. But Wilson says they both know from experience that it's not easy.
Once you find that one person that's into it still, like after you're coming out of recovery and you slip or whatever, you find that one person that does it, so, and then that just opens up a door to 50 people that do it. It's everywhere. You can't go to the grocery store or to a restaurant without seeing somebody you know, especially if you're from a smaller community. You know, not everybody's on the same, they're not coming out of prison and they're not in recovery. And, you know, when you're ready for it, it's always there.
Redding writes that meth doesn't just drive people apart, it drives them together. Once a community is shattered, not only will families splinter, but members will feel compelled to find succor in surprising places. Christine Wilson and Millicent Brown have both lost custody of their kids. Between them, they have a lifetime of experience that people who aren't addicts might have a hard time relating to. Still, Christine Wilson is determined that this time is different.
I have a really good support system around me, and I'm going to use that. I've been to prison 4 times, and this is going to be my last one. People say that a lot, but I know it. You know, I'm just done. I'm getting too old for it. I don't want to live that life anymore. I want to just have a nice, quiet life and make positive changes.
For her part, Millicent Brown hopes to reunite with her son and reconcile with her mother.
I'm currently working on healing my relationship with her, just because while being incarcerated, I've come to terms with spirituality and learning that forgiveness is probably my better remedy for a lot of things. And it's, I feel like, going to help me overcome my substance abuse problem just by learning how to cope with it rather than numb it out or use to get rid of memories or bad feelings that I'm feeling at the time.
Millicent Brown and Christine Wilson both seem determined to break the cycle. They look forward to getting out of the women's prison, to another new start. Their resumes have been disrupted by stints of jail time. Their families have been dispersed around the state. How they find meaning or solace or joy or fulfillment is on them. If they stumble, their road to peer is one they know all too well. For SDPB, I'm Michael Zimney in Peer.
That number again to call if you have questions about opioid addiction and abuse, drug abuse, 800-920-4343.